Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Professor David Vines makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. I should say also thanks to the Minerals Council of Australia for making Professor Vines available to us. I think they brought him to Australia and they've made him available to a number of places to talk, and one of them is the Sydney Institute, and we're very grateful for that. Now, I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. He was educated at the University of Melbourne and other places as well, but is currently Emeritus Professor of Economics at Oxford University and a Fellow at Balliol College. He's doing a fair bit of work these days in restoring trust in financial systems, and gave a speech on Melbourne on that about a week ago. And his most recent publication, of which there are many, but the most recent publication is a book on John Maynard Keynes, with Peter Temin, published by MIT Press. But tonight, Professor Vines is going to talk to us on the topic of transforming Australia into an outward-looking economy, why the 1940s matter. Professor Vines, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jared. And thank you all for welcoming me here. And let me begin by adding my thanks to the National Library of Australia. That is where I've been sitting and working for the last couple of months on this project, and my fellowship there is one that the Minerals Council of Australia has made possible.
You may need to lift your voice a little bit and speak into the microphone.
How's that for speaking? Very good. And I won't shout like giving a lecture to a large number of people either. First of all, I ask how it was that I came to be doing this work. I was an undergraduate at Melbourne, and I always thought that I'd have a policy-making career in the Treasury or in Canberra or in the Reserve Bank down the road from here. But I vividly remember the day when I thought I needed to go to the other side of the world and find out how that worked before I came back to Australia. And now, nearly 50 years later, I'm here talking about what I've learned on the other side of the world as a result of that time there. And I've been very fortunate to come back to Australia and learn about the history here. In Cambridge, I was very lucky to work with James Mead, who worked with Keynes, and that's how I came to be doing this, the work on Keynes. That made me realise that I could bring history to think about policy, and this is an exercise in both, using work that I've been able to see in manuscripts that I've been able to look at the National Library. In my work on Keynes, I've not just written that book, but another one as well. But the crucial aspect of what I've done is in working on the establishment of the Bretton Woods financial system. And this was written about by James Mead, who I worked with, in a formidably complicated book. And the person who brought it together was Trevor Swan. And this talk's going to be about how Swan used his experience in Australia to understand how... Thanks very much, Jeff. Terrific. To understand what he'd learned from this complex work that Mead wrote. In many ways, the saddest story is that Keynes died immediately after the end of the Second War, soon after the Bretton Woods institutions, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank were set up, and he never got to write the great book explaining how this is important as an institution and as a set of policy-making rules for the international economy and the national economies. Mead wrote 300 pages of difficult work and Swan produced it all to a two-dimensional diagram in the way that you'll all see later on. There'll be five parts to my story. The first, very brief, about what Australia was in the 1920s, then the Depression, and then an account of what happened in the war in two parts, and finally a description of what Trevor Swan did in bringing these ideas together. Where we begin is marvellous Melbourne, but really marvellous Australia. This is the exhibition buildings where once upon a time I did my exams at Melbourne, a temporary building that's still there, wonderful celebration of Australia, wool and gold in the 1890s, the richest place in the world, 1850s to 1890, to the end of the 1880s. And then a Great Depression from the 1890s onwards, as important for Australia and more fundamental in its effects than the Great Depression afterwards. And then there was the First War, and bringing the story of where Australia was just before the Depression together is a very famous exercise by a group of Australian economists led by these three who will become the first central players in my story. Copeland in the middle was asked to write a report on the tariff. He brought on board Brigden, his great mentor, who in this story that I will tell you had been a student at King's in Cambridge before Keynes and knew Keynes. Beg pardon?
Use Brigden with Giblin.
Yeah, Giblin above and yeah, Brigden yeah, in the yeah. middle. Thank you. And below, James Brigden, who in the end gave his name to the report. And I'd say I deliberately put this picture here because in the other room there is Parliament House without the sheep. And this story of the new country, but with still it's an extraordinary rural focus, gives a picture of what Australia was like at the time. The central story in this vision of Australia at that time was protection. And behind protection that enabled people to produce goods and sell them at higher prices was the wage-fixing system in Australia, which was central to the whole of Australian life, the way the arbitration system worked. And high wages in a protected economy encouraged immigration and encouraged foreign borrowing. And this was a story of how Australia had developed in that period after the great period of globalisation running up to the 1880s and beyond. At the expense of farmers and agricultural exporters and mineral exporters, at the expense of everybody who wasn't a protected producer of manufactures in cities. And there was no economic policy to speak of, a gold standard managed by the Bank of England, and banking policy managed by the Commonwealth Bank and other banks. There's the Bank of England in London, there's the Commonwealth Bank in Martin Place, and when exports were buoyant, more deposits in London, more lending in Australia, and when the Depression came, the opposite, less deposits from exports because the wool and wheat and gold price and the wheat price had collapsed, and less lending in Australia. And what the Australian, and here's the picture of farming poverty as a result of the collapse in prices and the spread of the unemployed in Sydney. There's a picture of a large dole queue. And we add to Brigden this, to Giblin, thank you, Jeff, I'm right and wrong way round, the mentor of them all, Lyndhurst Giblin, who, as I say, had been a student in Cambridge. Brigden, we've seen already. Copeland, the first professor of economics at Melbourne. And we add a fourth person, Leslie Melville, at a very young age, the first professor at Jeff Harcourt's Adelaide University, and then chief economist at the central bank. These four had an extraordinarily clear idea of what had happened to Australia in the Great Depression. The central idea was Giblin's, but they all understood the story that when farm income collapses, what you need is what you get is farmers with less income spending less, and the people who get less spend less, and the people who get less spend less. How much? Well, if each time round a third of the spending goes to imports, then you spend less by only two-thirds of what you had suffered in your first problem. And so it accumulates, and you get 2,000 added on to what was the initial 1,000 drop in export income. A multiplied story, and this is 6 years before Keynes understood it in the general theory. And economists, this group, wished to spread the burden of this, and they faced already a policy which broke the Labour government of wage deflation and wage cuts. Their crucial understanding, and it's central to my whole talk, was that you also needed to be able to not be stuck on the gold standard, but devalue your currency so as to improve the incomes of farmers by meaning that what they sold their exports for abroad was more valuable at home, and protecting the position of importers, of those who competed with imports, but meaning that imports cost more and farmers got more in relation to domestic incomes, so that you spread the burden. Centrally, the currency depreciation was an important part of what they did, but they hadn't yet quite worked out how to do it. At that same time, there was an imperial conference, Copeland again from Melbourne organising everybody. There's a wonderful account in the National Library papers of the proposals at the Imperial Conference that this group of economists produced, much clearer than anything else tabled at that conference. At the same time, the conference reinforced protectionism throughout the empire. As they said, first at home, then the empire, and then more or less to hell with everybody else. And that understanding of what had gone wrong, the beginnings of an understanding of what to do about it, managing the currency, but still in a world that was heavily protectionist, was the legacy of the 1930s. Central to the story, we go from real events to more ideas, was in 1936, Keynes's general theory, and Nugget Coombs, in his autobiography, describes this publication of this book as by far the most important intellectual event in his whole lifetime. And this established for professional economists the understanding that Australians has already had of this story of what goes wrong when there's a collapse in income and spending. Then comes the war, the Second War. And the most interesting parts of the Second War for my story have two components. The first was what happens domestically, and watching the people who I've been talking about before, now next generation, Roland Wilson, to become an important public servant, star pupil of these original Tasmanians, all of those, Brigden, Copeland and Giblin, had come into policy making in Australia from Tasmania, and now we add their star pupil who went first to England and then to Chicago to write very famous work on understanding international economics. And he brought in to this work one other Nugget Coombs, the picture that I had on the very beginning of my slide, the sketch drawing of Coombs. Here is Giblin again, by this stage an old man, retired, avuncular figure. There's a portrait of him by Dobell in 1945, holding this group of people together who he used as a sounding board. And the first story that they were asked to understand was how to pay for the war. The war was being managed at that stage by Curtin and Chifley. The fall of the fall of Singapore. No, I don't want to go there quite yet. Just the bringing of Australian contribution to international fighting was costly. How to understand how to pay for the war? First of all, they resisted the orthodox pre-Keynesian idea that you should put up taxes. Why? Because there were spare people still unemployed from the 1930s who could be brought into work. They then, whereas full employment was gained with this extra demand and the war going on, understood the need to raise taxes then in order to manage this war demand to prevent the war causing inflation as it happened during the First World War. And central to the work I've been doing in the National Library and the National Archives is a discussion between Giblin, who'd known people in England for, as I say, Keynes and his circle, discussion between Keynes and Giblin on how to pay for the war, exactly mirroring Keynes' own discussion of how to pay for the war in England. And you can see Giblin not yet sure how to apply that multiplier idea that I talked about earlier to the Australian circumstance. There's a wonderful letter from Keynes saying, "We've added up the numbers this way in Britain, I suggest you do the same." The fall of Pearl Harbor and the fall of Singapore brings America into the Pacific War, and the story of how this need to defend Australia became the central task for Curtin is the subject of a wonderful recent biography of Curtin, but also of Stuart MacIntyre's wonderful book on the post-war reconstruction. Why reconstruction? Because both Curtin and Chifley were determined that the war would not just be fought under the same circumstances, the First World War, and with an outcome, unemployment and social collapse after the war, but an opportunity for a new future. And the Finance and Economic Committee became the central group of people asked to do this, and they faced a central problem. How the international nature of the war was crucial to what was their need. How to pay for the war wasn't just a domestic issue. How to pay for the war is an international one. I'll keep that there. Thanks very much. Good. And the international issue was a central one in that the US constructed Lend-Lease as a generous response to the British need for finance. Lend-Lease, what is it? Congress asked Roosevelt. Is it a grant? No. Is it a loan? No. Will they pay interest? No. What is it? And he asked the State Department to find an answer, and the answer was, roughly speaking, the end of the empire. And this story of how Britain was required to sign on the dotted line against, and the crucial words were against discrimination against products in the importation of products in any country, Keynes, seeing this, said, does this mean the empire? And the answer was yes. And the central question was what to do when this was imposed on Britain. Thinking about this was what led Keynes to start working towards the new international monetary system that would be put in place after the war. How to manage a world in which trade would be bargained about and trade would be liberalised was the central question that they that they faced. And the Australian response to the similar circumstances is a remarkable story. When the fall of Singapore happened and the US entered the war, Australia was required to sign exactly the same clause. And the response of the Australian economists was to say this would be fine, providing the world was committed to full employment as a policy after the war. You remember I brought in back in my picture Nugget Coombs, who is famous for his writing of the full employment white paper in 1944-5, but central in the Australian discussions of what to do about the post-war world was a commitment to full employment policies. The Australians, this group, same people that I've been describing, insisted that those joining the International Monetary Fund actually commit to explicit full employment policies, something which the US would never agree to do. Keynes and indeed the American negotiator argued that they would get the outcome they wanted even without an explicit commitment. But this was central, and the Australians, both there and later in the foundation of the United Nations and in the negotiations towards a reducing of international tariffs on international trade, was central in arguing for that. The second thing the Australians were determined to do was to put pressure on countries like the US, which they were worried about would be in surplus after the war. One country in surplus must mean other countries in deficit. Pressure is necessary. But the third and fundamental thing that they added to this was freedom for countries to devalue their exchange rates, as had been the case for Australia in the 1930s, and as was being resisted by those who were setting up the Bretton Woods international monetary system after the war. And ultimately, this approach, which that was named the positive approach, didn't succeed, but it was central in understanding what had been achieved. When I say didn't succeed, this commitment to full employment, as distinct from in the Articles of Association of the International Monetary Fund, as distinct from an understanding that countries would attempt to do this. And why the positive approach? This was Coombs. People will think we're trying to be difficult. Let's turn it around and say we're not being difficult. We're advocating something positive, a commitment to a policy which all of those in the world, not just in Australia, will think is the right thing to do, having finished and won the war. So at the Bretton Woods Institution, the International Monetary Fund was established with no clear understanding that this was what was being done. Many, including Lang's followers in Australia and Eddie Ward and others in the left of Australian politics, thought that what was actually being done was a re-establishment of money power and the gold standard. Others, including my teacher, Mead, knew that there was a system that could be made to work, but what was it that would actually been understood and should be made to work was not clear. Like all international negotiations, you're never quite sure what's been agreed, and this was true of Bretton Woods. we flip forward to our understanding with Trevor Swan of how to bring all this together. Swan had not yet appeared in our story, but was a star, a pupil at the University of Sydney, the first part-time student ever to win a university medal, an astonishing achievement soon following in that he built the first econometric statistical model of an economy in order to show how Australia could have avoided the Great Depression. Central to his story was the kind of depreciation of the currency that I described earlier. By the late 1940s, he had become the chief economist from 1946 onwards in the Department of Post-War Reconstruction, managed by Nugget Coombs, who was, as I've said, at the centre of all this story. And there is, in the National Library, a wonderful series of papers in which Swan is having a discussion, mainly with Roland Wilson, who has been important in this story, this young protege of Giblin and the other Tasmanians, who was by this stage the... in the early war, he had become... let me go back to who Roland Wilson had been. In 1936, at the age of 32, he became the chief Commonwealth statistician in a world where there were no economists. That's the chief economic advisor to government. Soon after that, he was head of the Department of Labour and National Service, and by the early 1951, very young, he'd become permanent Secretary of the Treasury. He was then number two, and he and Swan were discussing what to do about Australian policy. And there was very significant concern. What to do after the war? In a world in which there is both a very large immigration program and very rapidly growing demand for goods and services, inflation, and a concern to make sure that the balance of payments didn't collapse as it had in the 1930s. And here is a story of one of the three sets of papers in the National Library about no understanding about what to do. And then early in the 1950s, in 1952, there's a wonderful note, again in the papers, about how in a discussion with Roland Wilson and someone become Fred Wheeler at the Treasury, Swan finally says, some algebra is necessary. And the algebra is all about how to achieve full employment and price stability and a satisfactory external economy. At the same time, how? By manipulating fiscal policy and the wage fixing of the Arbitration Commission and the exchange rate in an appropriate way. And the extraordinary achievement was to show how this could be done in this simple picture that Mead, as I said, had spent 300 pages explaining not terribly clearly. And the central idea was that if you have more expenditure stimulated by fiscal policy, then that will mean that you don't need to sell as many exports by being so competitive internationally in order to have internal balance or full employment in the economy. More exports mean that you need less domestic expenditure by policy. But conversely, if you have more domestic expenditure with policy, that will make things worse for your external position because more imports. You can get around that by having an improved cost position relative to the rest of the world. And that's what you can have represent the outcome of being on in a satisfactory balance of payments position? Well, the simple idea is that if you need two things, then you can manipulate these two instruments of policy to get the two things that you need. And this is a collapsing of an idea that was the idea that was central at Bretton Woods. And it's clear that Swan was able to achieve this as a result of his Australian experience of the 1930s, which what had been done then. It's also clear that the Australian experience of the country with an unsatisfactory external position makes it more difficult. That had been the story of what went wrong with the collapse of farming incomes in the 30s. The experience of ensuring through the Finance and Economic Committee that I've been describing that full employment was pursued by policy. And the post-war Australian experience showed just how these ideas should all be brought together. I want to end by just going very quickly to the other end of my story. You remember that I began by saying that Australia had settled for a very protectionist world in the 1920s. The Brigden Report was what I described of protection and wage fixing together, making the Australian growth prospect. But now, by the time that this picture was described by Swan, we have a story where the Australian understanding is that if you want to make sure that you have both external or internal balance, you need to ensure that both your domestic policy and your cost ratio is appropriate. I didn't deliberately talk about what this cost ratio is. You could achieve it either by devaluing the exchange rate or by being more protectionist. More protection means less imports, and that improves the balance of payments. And you could, if that's your objective, do it that way or with currency depreciation. What happens finally in the Australian story takes a very long time to get there. Immediately after the war, and I go back to the American demands for liberalising trade, which had been at the centre of understanding of how to set up the international monetary system, the Australians had participated in discussions about how to liberalise trade, but they were mainly interested in more market access for Australia abroad whilst remaining protectionist at home. And the story of how this changed takes until first the 1970s and then, importantly, the 1980s before it changes. And what becomes crucial in the 1980s is floating the exchange rate. Until the 1980s, although it had been understood that you needed to achieve both management of domestic policy and the right external cost ratio, in this story, this was always, in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, achieved by more or less restriction on imports, and then when restrictions on imports were removed as explicit quantity restrictions, by tariffs being more or less protectionist. But in the 1980s, one of the very crucial first things that was done by the Hawke-Keating administration was to float the exchange rate. What does that do? It means that the removal of protectionism, which becomes possible, the removal of protectionism becomes something that you can do without cutting protection, causing more imports, causing unemployment and causing political difficulties. As you cut protection, you can devalue the exchange rate and stimulate exports. And since then, there's been a realization that all of those things that were the original Brigden Report protectionist story can be done in other ways. Tax policy is a better way of redistributing income than the tariff was, which had taken income to the protected industries at the expense of farmers. And protection is no longer the way to increase real wages, but growth and capital accumulation and technical progress and an understanding of how to become technically modern is the way to do it. And this liberalisation that happened in this period laid the basis for the rebalancing. As I've said, if you want to improve the cost ratio, you can now do it by devaluing the exchange rate rather than by changing the level of protection. And this post-Hawke Keating world, there came to be a realisation that the objectives of policy that I've described can be brought about in other ways from protection. But the central story is understanding how to manage the macroeconomy in the way I told with this swan diagram and an understanding of what had been achieved at the Bretton Woods Hotel in this settlement was necessary for this political change that happened in the 80s to be brought about. Thanks very much.
So many thanks to Professor Vines, and once again thanks to the Minerals Council of Australia for making the Professor available to us at the Sydney Institute. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got to the top of the hour. Just hang on a second and we'll be away. Just going to lead off. I got you a bit more. It's a fascinating analysis, but by and large there's an absence of politicians. So I suppose if you're talking about bureaucrats, the key figure I think that intersects the 40s to the 50s is obviously Nugget Coombs. So yes. You make out, he's appointed in 1951, that's by Robert Menzies. So if you look at the period from Bretton Woods through to the early 50s, there seems to be a similarity in economic policy from the Labor government through to the coalition government, except, of course, Ben Chifley goes off the rails in 1947 with an attempt to nationalise the banks. If you give that away, apart from that, there seems to be a fairly constant policy there. Is that an accurate...
Absolutely true.
Just come back and speak here. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Into the microphone. Yeah. Comes in, brought by Wilson in 41... as part of this group of the Finance and Economic Committee giving advice, he's crucial during the period of writing the full employment white paper at home and these international negotiations which these Australians are involved in abroad. And it's in the early days, the Curtin and then the Chifley administration, supported enormously by both, and then by Dedman, the Minister for Post-War Reconstruction. The central part of my story is that there was a clearly thought-out framework that this group of economists had provided, which was carried over in important ways into the Menzies administration, so that when Coombs had been appointed by Chifley as the governor of the central bank in 1949, Menzies didn't get rid of him. So the Menzies then continued to work with this group of people, and this understanding of how the economy would be managed provided Australia with the framework for that extraordinary period of development that took place between the end of the war and 1971, when finally that picture of the Bretton Woods Hotel fell away from the world with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system.
Now, a lot of people here, we've got plenty of time if we're all brief. So we're going to go there, yeah. there. Okay.
Jeff, yes. Am I on the air?
Yes.
You are. I've heard David lecture many times. He's always the soul of lucidity and understanding. However, there are two things missing from the story. One is the stoushing of canes at Bretton Woods by Harry Dexter White and the Americans. So in effect, you had a modified form of gold standard implemented. And secondly, you haven't mentioned, which is a very important part of Australian economic policy in getting full employment and rapid accumulation, the Cowdor, Russell, Salter rules through the central wage fixing, which ensured that money incomes are adjusted for overall productivity plus prices.
Okay, now that's a bit technical for you might translate that.
Certainly.
You were short.
No, it's very short and clear. Yeah. The first story is the right one. The Bretton Woods institutions were not what Keynes wanted. And in particular, they were savagely difficult for Britain in the period after the war. And the Australians had been centrally worried about how taking Britain down after the war would be damaging to Australia. And Coombs and others fighting for that. In the long sweep of history, the recovery after the war of the Europe and Japan meant that the world had a remarkably long period of progress, even though the international institution had been not the one to support this that Keynes had wanted. So there's a long story there, and Jeff is on the right side of that story.
Now I'm on the wrong side.
the second story is about, if I go back to just describe this picture, the cost ratio story here, you need to have this in my picture right. And Australia understood, Jeff has said it again, more clearly than anyone else, when your price of your exports goes up, the Korean wool boom, when it falls subsequently, this has necessary implications for what you need to do for domestic wage fixing. So as Jeff said, not just steadily rising wages because of productivity, but an understanding that these need to be adjusted, but the formula, productivity plus the terms of trade. If you're doing well internationally, you can pay more. If you're doing less well internationally, pay less. And there's a long and interesting discussion, including my mentor James Mead coming to Australia and participating with Jeff's colleagues in Adelaide about this as a central part of that framework that was put in place. That's a long answer, but I think Jeff's on the right side of that part of the story too.
David, I'd like to go back a bit further. Because the bit that was left out is the connection between Gibbon, Brinton and Co. with Joseph Lyons. Both when he was Premier of Tasmania, they were great mates. They also gave him the belief that unproductive debt was bad for any economy. But when he became Prime Minister in the 1930s and brought Australia through the Depression, we had growth 10 times out of the United States that followed the Keynesian experiment, and I think Britain has doubled that. And one of the reasons
In the later 30s.
In the 30s, yes. Through from 32 to 39. And one of the reasons I think was, and you can comment on this, when imperial preference was brought in as a policy for the Commonwealth countries, Australia was in the black books with Britain because we interpreted that very loosely, and we engaged in a lot of trade with Japan and America. We were still very hooked on Britain. We couldn't get away from them. But I wonder if this has something to do with Brinton, Copeland and Co.
Next generation. Thanks, in front of the microphone. Thank you. With Brigden, with Coombs centrally, and then with Crawford later on, Jack Crawford. It was Crawford.
Thank you very much.
Good. Too many things. It was Crawford who understood after the war just how important opening of trade relations with Japan would be, but that's into
the
50s. And in the 30s, Australia had already begun.
That's right, and because
okay.
Lions
yeah. And so that says protection in Australia and imperial preference, but Australia was already beginning to look to the rest of the world for markets and engagement. Yeah.
Ida Lichter.
Thank you very much for your interesting... Push the black one round the other side.
Thank you very much for your interesting talk. On the subject of protectionism, how are you evaluating the current protectionist policies of the US administration and what effect it might have on us?
Awful. what effect... I'll answer sideways. Look at the bizarre situation that's happened in Britain, where some of a very small number of Tories in a very odd alliance with underprivileged people who've been very damaged since the great financial crisis have conspired to believe that by cutting trade relations with Europe, they are somehow free traders. And this is the most bizarre distortion of an understanding of international position possible. Similarly, Trump will have his supporters believe that what he's doing is being free trader because those they trade, the US trades against, are improper, imbalanced, inappropriate terms. How did those two things affect us? Importantly, by, and when I say us, I mean here, Australia, your question, engaging in Asia in the opening of trade and connections within the Asian region, and the regional comprehensive economic policy, RCEP, that is being negotiated in Asia, is crucial for the future of Asia. And the huge challenge for Australia is how this relates, what Australia's position should be in these negotiations, and how it relates to the Chinese One Belt, One Road initiative. Is that, like the Marshall Plan after the Second World War, heaps of money, you might say, to encourage opening, or is it heaps of money to encourage countries to turn towards China and their trading relations? And I think the Chinese genuinely aren't sure and haven't yet genuinely understood. And the task of international negotiation facing Australia and others in the Asia-Pacific region is these negotiations within Asia, which is now so important compared with the US and Britain in Europe, to be going forward in an opening, liberalising way rather than turning inwards in protection. What does that mean? There's the US. You do your best to hold that at bay, but at the same time, that's not your only game in town. An important one is the repeating of that extraordinary experience of the 1990s when the Asia-Pacific region opened and grew so fast. And that's what all of those negotiating these questions in Australia need to be thinking about.
There's a question there. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Professor. My question is about the solution that you said for being able to end protectionism but still maintain a balance of payment surplus by devaluing the currency. So if multiple countries are following that same course, how do you prevent a currency devaluation war?
Very right question. And the world is different after the global financial crisis from before. In the period until then, when the world was in an extraordinary period of growth, if any one country sought to do this, it all seems straightforward. If everybody seeks to do this, they can't obviously do this, but the end result is that they all have looser monetary policy and quite possibly fiscal policy, so that together this attempt to grow is not at the expense of everyone else, but but all grow. It's when you've reached, after the financial crisis, where an attempt to do, you asked, would quantitative easing come into the discussion, in order to devalue your currency, that is stealing jobs from other people, because other people can't do anything other than quantitative easing on their part. And the effects of quantitative easing were mainly of this stealing jobs from others rather than stimulating the economy in the way that would have been the case in the normal world. So in a well-functioning, growing world of the kind that we would like dearly to get back to, it's not a problem. But after the financial crisis, it's really been one.
We're going with David, and then we're coming here. Yeah.
Thanks very much, David. And you know, when you go back to this historical period, and it's a fascinating story to watch how these great minds were sort of stumbling towards an answer about what was necessary for a well-functioning economy. And this graph is a great example of that. And also an understanding of what instruments they had to try to achieve the results that they were doing. And again, this graph is very visual. But what is written about the challenge of actually calibrating these instruments to the goals that are there? You know, in a modern policy sense, policymakers are very well aware that it's very difficult to set any instrument at exactly the level you need to achieve internal, external balance, whatever is being targeted. Partly because the world is full of shocks, and every time you're getting close to something, another shock comes along. So amongst these minds that you've been examining the source material, is there any hint of the challenges that of actually operationalizing in a meaningful way these kind of theoretical frameworks, regardless of whether or not they are in fact capturing the essence of what you'd ideally like to achieve?
Huge, an interesting insight. Just to give you one example, I said that Trevor Swan, the earliest thing that he'd done was build one of the very second in the world, in fact, statistical model of an economy. In order, he asked the question with his model, how much would Australia have had to devalue its currency in order not to have had the Great Depression? And the number was a fantastically big number, and it came from the numbers in his exercise. But those of his generation began to do empirical and statistical modelling of the economy of the kind that goes on all the time at the bank now. And it's difficult. But the answer to it being difficult is not to say it's too hard and don't do it and just do simple rules. There was a backlash against this way of attempting to manage the economy, led by Milton Friedman in the early 1980s. And monetarism with simply set the money, couldn't even set the money supply because it turned out you couldn't control it as a central bank. The ambition was to do that and then go home early in the afternoon and let the economy manage itself. And the economy won't manage itself. So however bad or difficult the I'm saying this to you, you know your institution does it all the time. However difficult it is, it's necessary to get an understanding with an empirical model of how much to move. So now in Britain, in Australia, in the US, when the central bank in Australia, the Reserve Bank, meets to work out what it will do to the interest rate, in its inflation targeting regime, you need a combination of a model and good judgment to work out what to do. The model, this is in two dimensions, but just imagine understanding the full workings of the Australian economy. You just say, well, let's try and carefully analyse this model, but there's farming and there's, I think of the Minerals Council, that there's the mining industry and the cities. There are already three different kinds of activity. And you say, I can't do this in my head with a spreadsheet. I begin to need the best model I can. I've just edited an issue of a journal about how difficult this is. And I think the great message from that journal issue was, don't be misled because the model looks exact into believing that you exactly understand the world.
We have time for a very quick question and quick answer.
Yeah, just a comment on two distortions in our labour market. The first being the income transfer system, which means people are paid more for not working if they've got a family than for working, meaning we have so many imported and backpacker and foreign labour. And the second one, it would be the distortion of a centralised wage fixing system, which means that you can't employ somebody more cheaply in the regional areas than you can in Sydney.
Two bits of that, and very quickly, that is a central part of Australian discussions ever since the end of the Second War to now. The change in the welfare system that's happened in Australia, I think, in the last 30 years has been extraordinarily important in whilst trying to provide welfare support, also attempting to do this with an obligation to attempt to find work and not to set out to have a life that's supported through not trying. Now, I venture into something which is a huge and important discussion. But I think that the Australian sense of obligation that goes with the welfare system is an important and distinguishing one about the Australian welfare system. And it takes us straight into the disability NDIS, where there are some people, however much obligation they feel, need support. And that's the first thing. And second, you asked about the centralised wage-fixing story. A central part of the Hawke-Keating reforms, which I described to you, which we haven't had time to talk about, is how much these have been the wage-fixing system has been transformed since that period. You talk about that regional question. It's much less than it was. And there is, I don't know about the way regional labour markets work in Australia, but the thing that I'm very struck by was how flexible, let's not use that word, but how adaptable the Australian labour market system was to what happened with the mineral boom when people moved to the West and then move back again when the terms of trade fell. That wouldn't have been possible 50 years ago. I think the adaptability of the system and the adjustment of the system has been important. Central to that has been the exchange rate movements, which have encouraged people to come back to Eastern Australia when the currency went down, when the return to minerals exporting fell. So again, this story, very simple in this picture, is coupled with an understanding of how the labour market works. Long discussion to have about that.
Many thanks. We're right on time, so and you have a plane to catch, so we're going to be very brief.
Well,
many thanks to Professor Vines. The topic was essentially on the 1940s, but as we saw in the talk and during the question discussion period, so much of what occurred then was relevant to today and through the 50s and into the current era. So we're very grateful for a stimulating speech. I see you've got a longer paper here which we'll publish, but tonight you've given the highlights of that paper, and we're very grateful for that. A lot to think about. And we love history at the Sydney Institute, so it's always good to have economics with a bucket load of history. So well done and good luck.
Thank you. And could I say one thing in wanting to thank the National Library in Canberra for making it possible for me to do this work? It's been an extraordinarily interesting experience, and great debt of gratitude to the library for making this possible. Thanks.
Thank you. That's great. Well done. Thank
you. You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.